Egg and toast.
Egg and toast.
I'll Midwestern it.
Just keep on giving me that sweet old job, right?
Hey, everyone else. This is Daniel.
What's up?
Hi. Hey, Daniel.
The Plofmaster.
He's Plofmaster.
Hello. Postmaster. You work in delivery?
No, Plof. Not post.
Oh.
I thought maybe he just already was familiar with the whiskerino-izing of my screen name.
Daniel, I found your Google Plus. You have a beard.
See, I actually haven't used Google Plus in probably...
Since July 14th.
Yeah, there you go. Nice. I pretty much just commit to Twitter.
Yeah, that's for the best.
Yeah, I check out the occasional new social media daily, but it's not that I'm making a particular value judgment about Google Plus. Yes, I am, but I just kind of... I don't want to be inundated with social media, so I just kind of stick to one.
What is a P-loaf?
See, there's strike one right there.
Uh-oh.
It's never P-loaf, ever. If there was meant to be a space, I've included a damned underscore.
So we have a couple of username handles to talk about, because I was trying to... Like, I was talking to Daniel about everyone who's calling in, and he's like, "This midnight cheese." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm not sure what that was. I think you've told me, but I can't remember."
It goes way back. I used to draw this little character called Midnight Cheese. He was kind of like a little, not a little more than a stick figure, but he wore a little crown on his head, and I don't know, it was just, you know, totally random name, and it's just kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And what is Plofmaster?
That's a much longer, weirder, more dull and convoluted story, probably. But I could kind of give you the short story on where Plof comes from.
Okay.
And the sad truth is that its origins really do come from a separation of that P and the loaf. which I was depressed to discover after my undergraduate years. How many people here are familiar with, like, old school Mac gaming? Anyone?
A little bit.
There was Bungie, the video game development house. And I'm not really much of a gamer, but I knew that, like, you know, before they were owned by Microsoft, they were a Mac game shop. And they had a real-time strategy game in the late 90s called Myth. Not the insufferable.
Not Myst.
Myst, yeah. Not the I need a notebook to have fun with my computer.
I loved that game. You need a notebook to enjoy. What the hell is it called? Oh, with the text based thing, the typing people. Zork. Yes, Zork. You have to have a notebook to enjoy Zork also.
Enjoy yourself, man.
Yeah.
Continue, Daniel. I'm sorry.
Oh no, that's fine. It was an early game that had some robust multiplayer over the internet kind of capabilities, and so they called their teams orders, and you could have, you know, a whole bunch of teams playing in a given match and whatever. So me and two of my buddies always played. We had our little team that was called the Gun-Toting Ferrets, with a little. Cute little ferret from a calendar carrying a Desert Eagle over his shoulder.
Sweet.
But yeah, we used to see this team all the time when we were playing, and their team name just said Plof. No graphic to tell you what it might have been. Just Plof. And you could chat before and after a match, and we always asked them what it was because it just looked hilarious, and they never answered. And so we just started using Plof as our own kind of any part of speech, which when you're in high school naturally means profanity, profanity substitute. So,
like, I got to go take a plof.
Well, that's what happened in Whiskerino. It just kind of solidified it, as it were. And now, you know, folks as far away as Scotland and New Zealand know plof to mean poop. So, but yeah, I mean, years later, I remember just searching for the word Plouffe on the internet to see if anything unassociated with me came up in the results. And I found some old leaderboard for ladder play on Myth. And there were lists of teams, and this team was there with some little short profile, and their name actually was an abbreviation for the Pimento Loafers, which was about, you know, not only was it depressing to me that it was actually kind of an abbreviation instead of a silly made-up word, but it was probably the dumbest thing I'd ever heard, the Pimento Loafers. So there's the exciting, you know, thrilling story of how Plouffe came to be.
Nice.
Yeah, right. Everyone here is now dumber having heard you speak.
But so something else that might be of interest to people here is I'm looking through your Flickr page for this. You recently met Merlin Mann.
Oh, heavens yes.
Cool.
Hold on, I'm going to find this picture and then I'm going to put it in the... So what happened there? Here it is. This is a great picture.
Yeah. That was actually awesome when that happened because, I guess on Back to Work, he's often referenced the coffee shop in his neighborhood called Brown Owl Coffee. And my wife Valerie and I were in San Francisco for a short vacation at the beginning of August. And so I was like, well, you know, I want to check this coffee shop out because, you know, San Francisco is supposed to have some decent coffee. We went to Blue Bottle. It was really good, but it was, you know, I wanted to check out this other place because I knew Brown Owl roasts their own beans and really small shop, like, I think like a husband and wife basically run it. So Merlin lives like apparently way out in the west part of the city in like the Sunset District, kind of more residential and away from all the touristy crap. So we're riding out on the El Taraval line and we're heading out in that direction. And we're sitting on there and my wife, who is not a nerd like by typical standards, I mean she's a commercial interior designer and not into computers, but she listens to Back to Work and a couple other, she listens to Let's Make Mistakes on 5x5 and couple other things. So she just said, you know, wouldn't it be really crazy if we actually saw Merlin Mann? And I was like, yeah, but you know, it's like a big city. And so we get off at our stop right on the corner across from where the coffee shop is, and as soon as I turn around when we're standing on the sidewalk, there's Merlin Mann walking right up. Like within 30 seconds of getting off the train. So, and, no, he, you know, so I'm not going to read.
You accosted him.
Well, I just kind of like pointed at him like a tool and was like, oh my gosh, you're Merlin Mann. And I'm wearing, you know, as you can see, I'm wearing a talk show t-shirt, wrapped around my ample man boobs. but you know, he was actually really cool. I mean, I think John Gruber's described him as being really generous with his fans, like with his time. And I found that to be pretty true. He was, he's just really hard to keep up with.
Yeah, I don't think I ever actually caught the name of any of the shops he's talked about because he talks a mile a minute. And
yeah,
I get like a gist after like listening to one of his shows. Like, I can't remember any specifics because it's just like, but.
Well, you see the second comment on that photograph that you linked to. Somebody says, and this is what my wife thought the same thing. He goes, this whole time I'm saying Brown Owl Coffee. So he was pretty darn cool. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, I tend to, like, I overreact to minor celebrity, the most minor of celebrity. Like, there's one of my Flickr contacts is a professional photographer here in Richmond. And when I actually met him in person and actually hung out with him once, I practically flipped my lid. But I met Anthony Hopkins, like, when I was in VCU as an undergrad and totally kept it cool.
Yeah.
I don't really know why I'm like that. I kind of – it's not like I was trying to play it cool with Anthony Hopkins. I just, for whatever reason, you know.
Yeah.
Photographer equals totally geek out. Anthony Hopkins equals, hey, man.
That's cool. I can dig that. Steven, I'm excited to hear about what you've been doing the last week.
I've been railsing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Much like the photo you posted to Instagram, railsing.
Yeah, yeah. Did you rails in Ireland?
No, not that week.
Oh, okay.
Since I got back, it's almost been a full week. On that kind of stuff all week. But Ireland was fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to, but the railsing would be good too.
I have a full little notebook, completely full of notes from the conference. It was a totally amazing event. It's a great environment. Lots of cool people, and not that many people from the United States.
Oh, yeah?
Just a fraction of the people, a small fraction from the United States. It was really interesting. But we I'll just go chronologically. We had a movie night. We watched this preview of this film about the Linotype, the fantastic machine that revolutionized printing in the 19th century. It was used all the way until the 60s. And we got to see Urbanized, the new movie from the guy that did Helvetica.
Gary Hustwit,
yes. That movie was great. And we also had a workshop day, and I learned about responsive design from Jeremy Keith. That was excellent. That I need to blog about that, because there were a lot of good takeaways from that.
Do you have like a normal bloggy blog?
I mean, I kind of did. When you say normal, like, it's been a while since I updated it. But
oh, yeah. Did you have, like, stephenbush.com or something?
I do. It's at
blog. There you go.
StephenWyattBush.com. Anyway. So it's there.
Please continue. Sorry.
There was actually a day off of, like, free time to work on fun projects or work right in the middle of the conference, which I thought was brilliant. And to have a day to recover after all that traveling and drinking, because every single day there's also some kind of drinking event scheduled. Because you're in Ireland, and everybody just drinks a lot.
Stereotype here.
I mean, a lot. And then there was the full conference day, which was a handful of speakers, including Wilson Miner from RDO.
And Django.
Jason Santa Maria. Yes, he did Django. He also worked on the first big Apple redesign.
Like the store website, or?
It was a while ago, but the first comprehensive redesign of the site.
Oh, okay.
He helped make it look so cool.
And you're going to talk about his presentation.
Yeah. I'm hoping there's a video that's going to be out there, but it was just absolutely amazing, and he managed to touch on, like, to evoke everybody's emotions immediately, and then to have impressive visuals, and sometimes he would cue up music while he was speaking in just the right way that you felt like how the music plays in, like, a movie when you're watching somebody speak. But it was in real life. You know, people don't really do that very often at these conferences.
Yeah, AV, you know, issues are always a problem with things like this, it seems like. So that's impressive that he was able to
get that to work. Like dramatic piano music with like an orchestra building behind what he was saying whenever he was driving home a point. And the whole thing, he talked about tools, the tools we use, and how we shape our tools, and therefore our tools shape us, which I believe is a Marshall McLuhan thing. Talked a lot about Marshall McLuhan, but he spoke on a very high level about what we do, and then after he had gotten us excited about work and touched on all of our emotions, he left us with a call to action to go out and build stuff. It was just amazing.
Nice. Yeah, I hope there's a video of that too, because Twitter was blowing up with people talking about that, gushing about it, like right after it happened.
He got the only standing ovation of the conference. Even the wrapping it up applause at the end of the conference did not get a standing ovation, but he did.
Wow.
I mean, it was a fantastic conference. Everybody loved it, but everybody felt moved to stand up after he spoke.
So what was the title of the talk?
The Tools We Use.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
I believe he's giving it again soon somewhere, the same talk.
Yeah, that's cool. I've never seen anybody score their speech before. That's a cool idea.
Yeah. I imagine that could be a nightmare to implement, but...
Oh, I'm sure.
That's awesome.
It looks like you put some time into it and really thought it through.
Yeah.
And it paid off. There were other good presentations, too. I just really can't remember any of them except his. Luckily, I took notes. One night we were there, we got to have an evening with Eric Speakerman and hear him present. Eric Speakerman is a German type designer. He's done all sorts of typefaces that you've used and know.
Has he done my favorite?
What's your favorite?
Verdana.
No, he did Meta.
I'm sorry.
And he's done a bunch of corporate typefaces. Oh, it's not? Because some people just came out with a Verdana Pro and a Georgia Pro.
I really don't like Verdana at all.
I'm actually relieved to find that was sarcasm.
Yeah. I was like, I think Microsoft really made that.
Yeah.
I kind of like it.
I'm still bitter over IKEA choosing to use that in their catalogs instead of
Helvetica.
Sure. No, they were using Futura.
Okay. Yeah, I do like Futura.
I'm a Futura junkie, so... But my favorite typeface, I think, is even dorkier than that. It's Gil Sans.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I use that in iChat for my default typeface.
Nice.
Not even. I think it's like a lower X height type, too, so it's not really the best for reading really small.
It's really hard to read, yeah.
But I just really like the way it looks, and I think that's... I think it was based off of like the London Underground typeface, or the other way around, or something ridiculous like that.
Hmm.
I use a monospace font in iChat.
Which one?
Monaco.
Do you double space after all your sentences then?
Monaco.
That's wrong.
See, I got...
It's got unispace. If you're typing with like a monospace font, I think that'd make it easier to read if you do that.
I
suppose so. But, I mean, who really punctuates an instant message?
Yeah, not so much. Oh.
You're asking the wrong guy.
But if you guys...
My stuff is as I type.
You guys ever used Inconsolata?
Yes.
I'm not sure. Okay, is that how you pronounce that? Benjamin did a post on monospaced fonts a while back.
Did.
And ever since then, I've been using Inconsolata everywhere. And I really like it. I had been using Monaco before because that's... the default TextMate. So, yeah. Fonts. How did we get on fonts?
How did
Speakerman?
No.
Speakerman.
And he is a fantastic speaker. Very entertaining. I actually saw him a year ago in New York too, and he's just very blunt. Rough around the edges, hilarious kind of guy.
Does that mean he uses dirty words?
Yes.
Sweet.
Like butt?
Like plof?
Yeah.
Yesterday he tweeted that he's in bed with pneumonia, and pneumonia is not a girl's name.
I think that was some wasted potential. He could have gone a lot deeper with that.
But when he showed up at the conference, he told us that he had just been diagnosed with pneumonia, so I did not.
So that was serious? Yeah.
Yeah, he really had pneumonia. Don't you feel bad for making fun of him?
Yeah.
No, I'm the cold-hearted bastard that does not.
So where the hell is Phil? Daniel, where's Phil?
I don't know.
Crazy.
There's a couple hundred thousand other people in the Richmond metro area.
Yeah.
Between me and him.
You guys are biffies, though.
No excuse.
Last time I saw him was sampling beer outside of a dude's garage in Church Hill.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
How's Richmond these days? I haven't been back there in friggin' like 3 years.
It's pretty glorious. I'm still a fan. I admit I'm considering the allure of New York City after I finish up with grad school.
Oh.
Nice.
But it's such that if I was quote unquote stuck in Richmond, I would not be the least bit disappointed because I still love Richmond quite a bit.
It's a great place.
Why New York instead of San Francisco?
Well, the thing about New York is that I'm a Jersey boy, and so I've been to New York. And when I say New York, I really mean Manhattan. But I've been there more times than I can count, and so I just have kind of like a really deep from childhood love of that city. And I don't know. I mean, there's even if I was that far away from Richmond, it's still like being on the East Coast is quite a bit different and much more accessible to everyone else I know on the East Coast than going all the way out to SFO. I like San Francisco. It was the first time I went there in August, and it was wonderful. And I am going to throw an application at Cupertino, but I don't think it'll stick.
So, yeah, that
I'm honest.
That's a good segue. So what do you do?
Well, oh, man.
For the audience.
I really always get self-conscious about this with this kind of audience, I'll be totally honest. I mean, I was self-conscious about it when I went into it. Like, my actual day job is I'm a business analyst at an IT consulting company. But, like, I'm in an MBA program right now. So, you know, it's like a couple layers of douchey right there.
I have a business degree.
Not
an MBA. Yeah.
Because I know there's like very justifiable suspicion and animosity toward people with MBAs from particularly the web-centric and kind of creative web end of like the IT world. And to be totally blunt, I'm terrified by most of my classmates because most of them really, I mean, the stereotypes are justifiable as well. Most of the people that are in the program with me are there because they want to be an executive making the big dollars. That's their motivation. They don't really know why they went into grad school other than that, or because their company was paying for it 100%. And so why not?
Wow.
It's a box on their checklist to get a promotion to management.
Wow. And that's not what you want to do.
No, I really don't. Like I'm in business grad school so that I have a broader understanding about the way that like the larger business community works. Because even if I don't need that to run my own business, I need that to understand how a lot of potential clients are working and thinking. So that's kind of my reasoning. I think, you know, other folks' mileage may vary. I'm not often self-motivated enough to just sit down and read the right books. So I think if that is a learning style that works for somebody, I think that's probably the better route to go. And so, you know, while I've sidled myself with enough student loan debt to buy a luxury automobile, to some extent, I actually just value the pure educational experience. I mean, that sounds kind of silly, I guess, but it's just kind of my old school view of what education is for. Like, if I got a job outside of grad school and it paid the same amount that I made before grad school and it took me 20 years to pay off my student loan debt, there's a part of me that's totally okay with that because and so I'm sure that's like that's certainly contrary to like pretty much every one of my classmates' point of view, but I'm sure it would be contrary to most folks' point of view. They wouldn't want to, like, understandably wouldn't want to drop all that coin on a degree if they don't think they could do something with it. But
when you look at the web, there are a large number of people whose education does not directly relate to what they do at all.
It sounds like you just took the survey. What the hell? Event apart?
A list of parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We make websites.
Yeah, which I took that survey today. That sounds just like one of the questions. Did your degree actually help you in what you do?
But, it helps, but it doesn't relate.
Yeah. So Daniel,
that's a real important statement, though. Like, really, it helped, but it doesn't relate. Like, I think that sums up kind of how I feel about it. It's like, to me, if I just like somehow out of like miracle of miracles was able to be a full-time photographer and never did anything with IT again, I would still consider that, like, if I had gotten some graduate degree, that there's got to be something there, even if I don't recognize it today. Something about that experience is going to be, like, instrumental to the way that I deal with whatever I'm doing 5 years from now.
So the way that I see you, Daniel, is like a gourmet travel food blogger photographer. That's how I think of you.
Man, if only. Holy crap.
I mean, you travel all the damn time. You take gorgeous photos, and you like, have these long in-depth blog posts and photo whatever essays about like Charleston. Like
that's very flattering, but you know what the key thing is there? Like did you see me write anything negative about Charleston or much negative about Charleston?
No.
Like I tend to just really like effuse about those places that just kind of amaze me. And well, you know, I don't want, you know, there's plenty of food writers out there who are negative all the time, but I think it's just as bad to be to come off sounding like you're Pollyanna about eating in a restaurant. You know, like this restaurant's amazing, and then you just think that I'm always enjoying everywhere that I go.
Well, maybe you only review places that you like, and then if it doesn't show up, then it's not. It's like, you know, that polite thing. Where if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. You're the polite food blogger.
But even that slowed down because the number of interesting restaurants, there's plenty of restaurants that open in Richmond. The number of interesting restaurants opening in Richmond are few and far between. And B, I really just started eating at the same restaurant far too often. So
I want to see the photo essay on comfort.
Oh man. There's a recent photograph that I took in there, but you wouldn't know it. Otherwise, I haven't really done a lot in comfort, but I should. It's just, it's always so dark in there, man.
Yeah.
I think I just bought their mac and cheese from probably across the street, though.
Meatloaf. They had really good meatloaf, didn't they?
Yeah. There was, some of the stuff they do is downright fancy. Like, I was there with a buddy of mine from class, and we had, it was a pork belly appetizer that was just nuts. And when you're just sitting there at the bar drinking, like, all kinds of awesome bourbon and eating something like pork belly, it's just, it's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, someday I'd love to take some more pictures in there. It's just, I don't want to be the dork with the flash bouncing off the ceiling and disturbing all the patrons.
Damn patrons. All right, so
Steven and Kale, yeah, have you guys ever even been to Richmond?
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Richmond's great.
Yeah.
You know what would be key, though, is if you go, like, I've only been to Nashville once, and it was for the Whiskerino Throwdown in February 2010. And it was my one and only time I've been there, and it was just for, like, a weekend. But every single activity just about was kind of curated by someone who knew the town quite well and knew where really cool stuff was.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that despite the short duration of my stay, it just felt like there was a lot of awesome packed into that short time. I would go back to Nashville in a heartbeat because of that. Nice. So like if you come to Richmond, it's like great if you're able to go with somebody that has that kind of like similar understanding of it, so that you kind of, because if you come, Richmond's a small enough town that if you don't really know what to look for, it can be really boring. Unless you just really love Civil War monuments.
Right.
that's probably true of any town, though, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those Civil War monuments in Albuquerque.
No. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The best. All right. I'm like self-conscious of how much I'm just like talking a lot, so I'm gonna be quiet for a few minutes.
Well, you can be quiet during the Star Trek section. Oh, well, you did watch some of it, though, didn't you?
I did watch part one. I just didn't get a chance to get to part two yet, so semester's almost over.
So let's just go down the list more. Okay, Steven, did you have anything else you wanted to say about the Build conference?
No.
That's it?
It was great.
Are you sure?
For now.
Okay. And so, Steven, you added the bulk of the notes for this week, so thank you. The next thing, then you said Guinness. Is there anything you want to say about Guinness?
Oh, it really is different over there. It's much better.
Really?
Taste-wise and everything?
Yeah, I had way too much of it.
Interesting.
We have been hung over for a full 8-hour transatlantic
flight. Are you feeling better now?
Yeah, but okay. That night I went out and I swore, I'm not going to be hungover on the flight. I'm not going to drink that much. And it's just so delicious that it happened.
How does it, like, what does it taste like?
Yeah.
It just tastes smoother and creamier.
Is it like the nitrogen infused, like the bubbles are smaller and the whatever?
Yeah, I was curious what the difference was, and people say that when you drink Guinness from a tap that pours it the most often, it's the most delicious. And it's just generally poured more often there.
So it seasons the tubes.
Therefore more delicious. And it's also fresher always. You're not getting something that's been sitting there for a week.
Is that all you drank was just Guinness?
No, there was actually a craft beer festival as part of the conference.
Holy shit.
Local Irish craft beers.
I want to go to this conference.
Yeah, really.
Definitely go next year. It's fantastic. The organizer is a really cool dude, and he is younger than me.
That's young.
And right, so I'm 25. I believe the organizer was like 24, and he's been doing it for years. And I remember over a year ago, I was listening to a podcast. It might have been Boag World or something. They interviewed this kid who had been organizing a conference against his parents' wishes, and it was this guy. Put it all together.
That's
so
awesome.
He's been doing this for years, since he was in his teens, and it's wildly successful. It's just a great conference. And I've heard him talk about like how he does it, and he just sets up things that he's interested in. And luckily, other people like it, too.
So here's the question here. When are you going to speak at one of these conferences?
I have no idea. What would I speak about? I mean,
you gave a great speech at a dev chat.
I mean, that was good. But, I mean, one day maybe I'll get my blogging in line, and then that'll be more likely.
Whatevs.
But that would be fun.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that these talks were less about details and implementation and more about high-level concepts relating to what we do as web and creative professionals.
Sounds good.
Yeah, right on.
That's all I have to say.
Okay. Pizza.
Pizza.
Mercy.
Oh, man. Yeah. An incredible recipe for Naples-style pizza.
Pizza Napoletan.
The best style. There's a place here in Atlanta that makes really authentic Italian pizza. They have three ovens all flown in from Italy, and they cook each day until their dough runs out and they close. But this is a recipe for the real deal. And we've been talking about food a bit lately, so I thought I'd add it. I'm about to try it. I haven't tried it yet. I just got it today from a coworker who is very enthusiastic about cooking pizza.
Nice.
It might help to have a pizza stone and an oven that you have cut all of the safety cords so that it goes up to like 700 degrees or something.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you really get into it, you'll coat the inside of your oven in foil and cut the safety wires The reason for the foil is that if, like, moisture were to fall off the pizza and hit the oven would shatter. That's why you need to have foil in there.
Jeez.
Wow.
Which was the reason for the safety cords, right?
Totally.
So you can't get up to 450.
Yeah.
Are there safety cords?
If you want to cook a pizza, you have to get way higher than that.
Yeah. Are there safety cords or something like that on a gas oven? How does that work?
There are numerous safety features, I know. We have a gas oven. And, there's all sorts of low-rate detectors that are kind of even outside the oven box, kind of at the base of the oven that will, if the gas is moving too quickly, it just cuts the whole thing off and kills your oven.
So I just sent over a link to a Flickr photo. There's this woman, Victoria DeRoche, in Richmond, who runs a business called Pizza Tonight. And she started out just kind of selling these kits where she made her own pizza dough. And she still sells those in stores, but she actually has this trailer hitched, like, custom-made, wood-fired brick pizza oven. And this is the second best pizza I've ever had in my life, the best being in Naples.
Mm, nice.
This woman has really freaking, like, perfected pizza making. And it is real, like, Napolitan pizza, and it's for serious. And so this thing, like, will drag around, like, behind wherever she's going. And cool. She knows what's what.
Nice. I want pizza now.
I am really hungry all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, this recipe says it takes up to 2 days refrigerating and everything.
Slow fermentation, baby.
It's quite the process. Yeah.
Better flavor.
Wow.
Is that the crust? You have to wait 2 days for it to...
Yeah.
I think so.
Basically, the crust, it fills with oxygen in your refrigerator or wherever it's waiting, and that way when you put it in the oven, there's all those oxygen bubbles, and they just get really huge, and that's how you get that big crust.
That's what she said.
Yes.
I always just buy my crust from Trader Joe's. That's probably not as good, huh?
You could do a lot worse. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're going to buy some pre-made crust, that's probably a better idea.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Ooh, what's Noodle Kugel?
Do you know Noodle Kugel, Daniel?
I kind of got lost on the cottage cheese part, but that's because I'm picky.
You don't like cottage cheese?
Hell no.
What?
Give me a good, like, proper ricotta cheese, and that's the
ricotta.
Right stuff.
Ricotta.
Ricotta.
I bet that'd be good, in it?
I'd have to cut out the sour cream, too. Maybe use some mascarpone instead.
What?
Then it'd be, like, Italian version.
What?
Maybe it'd be, like, noodle kugele.
the
macaroni.
It's friggin', like, noodle pudding with raisins and cinnamon and sugar. Like, it's only good things. Mm.
I almost choked on some whiskey when you said noodle pudding.
How is that bad?
That's... How can it be all good?
That's just gross. It just sounded hilarious.
I would never put raisins into the category of good things.
Oh, Steven, you're off this podcast.
Ouch.
Clean out your desk.
Not a lot. Come on.
He cannot like raisins. So I mean,
I had raisins for breakfast.
Raisins are the best.
And then you had a poopy for lunch.
Hey, whatever
loaf.
Works.
Listen. Oh my goodness. Wait, Steven, so is everyone else a raisin lover here?
No.
Yes.
Wait, who said no? Who said no?
Me, Jason.
What? Jason.
Oh man.
God, you people. You're killing
so
me.
Flavor.
You are killing me. Oh, yeah.
Raisins.
What was that?
Raisins are better.
No, they're not. They're most definitely not better. They're okay, but they ain't raisins.
No. Very no.
I don't have anything else to say about Noodle Kugel. It's apparently a
noodle pudding.
It's so good. Yeah.
So this is a dessert that I will make.
Yeah, but only if you put raisins in it. Stephen, what? And Stephen and Jason both. What do you put in your oatmeal?
Cinnamon.
Cinnamon and butter, and I think sometimes nuts.
All right.
That's like a perfect opportunity for me to shoe in a mention about brown butter.
That sounds dirty.
It does, but it'll make almost everything you make with butter taste better.
Tell me about brown butter, because it just sounds like something you would like change your underwear for.
Mud butt.
Wow.
No, brown butter is so butter's got like three things in it. Basically, it's milk solids, fat, and water. So if you put it on the stovetop on high heat, the water starts to boil as it melts. And once all the water boils off, or enough of it boils off, the remaining fat starts to cook the milk solids, and it starts to brown. And so, you know, when that happens, it just kind of gets to be a lot more kind of complex flavored and starts to smell a little nutty, and it will make scrambled eggs taste like they came out of an expensive kitchen.
Hmm.
It's really, really, really easy to learn how to do it, and so, it makes almost anything better.
How do you do it?
Pretty much just like I described it, butter on high heat.
That's it, until it, like, almost burns.
Well, egg and toast.
The tricky part is that it will go from brown to black in a hurry.
Hmm.
So it's but the easiest way to keep it from burning, once you see that it's turned brown and you can smell it kind of starting to smell like toasted nuts, insert your own joke here, then you just add your food to it, and that cools down the pan enough that it's not going to burn it. Otherwise, you could just like pour, if you're going to use it for something later, like add it to something that you're baking or add it to any other dish. Like some people have made like ice cream with brown butter or other kinds of desserts with it. You can just pour it right out of the pan into like a cold dish and it'll cool off. If you want to filter it, you can, but you don't have to. It's just, it's really quick to make. It's like if you take 5 extra minutes before you're cooking something, you can cook it with brown butter and people will think that you're like some amazing cook just for spending 5 extra minutes.
Do you have to tell them that it was brown butter?
If you're kind of like, you know, really prideful like I am, you do. if you like to toot your own horn, then yes.
Nice. I will have to try that. Cool. Yeah. So Steven says put brown butter on egg and toast. That's for you, Daniel.
How do I put it on egg and toast? I've looked at egg and toast before, but I didn't know I could add something to it.
Yeah. Register.
Oh. Well then.
You know. If you want. Cool.
Egg and toast.
Egg and toast.
I'll Midwestern it.
Okay, any other cooking stuff? Has anyone made something amazing in the last week?
I haven't made anything, but I should have put this in the notes earlier. I came across an article today. I posted it to Twitter about making your own mushrooms. And it seems like a really easy process. These are cooking mushrooms, by the way. Just, you know, just in case you're wondering.
That sounded like something else that you have to change your underwear for.
But you buy these plugs, you get a log, you drill holes in the log, you put these mushroom plugs in there, and you pretty much just let this log sit in the elements, and eventually you have mushrooms coming out of it that you can harvest. And I guess a log lasts for like 6 years worth of mushrooms. So,
is it like, what kind of mushroom is it?
Well, the article mentions, you know, all different types. Of edible mushroom. So apparently it's the same process for all of them.
Okay. Like portobello or button or your typical pizza mushroom. Right? What are those called?
Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
Morel. Can you grow morels like that?
I don't know. I have to look at the list and see which ones they.
Because those are like rare and incredibly expensive.
Yeah, there's a link in the article to this guy that sells all the different kinds of mushrooms. So I will add that to the page.
Awesome.
Well, I made pizza with the kids last night, but I found out, Trey, I just bought dough at the grocery store like you did.
Yeah. What'd you put on it?
It was just straight up, just pepperoni and cheese.
Mozzarella?
Yeah, my daughter only likes to eat pepperonis and mozzarella. Well, we use like a but Benny's hot with the sun. He loves it, particularly black olives and mushrooms. He loves it. Gets crazy about olives.
That's gross.
I told him, man, he and my wife were just like down a can of olives before we ever get the pizza made. My daughter helps me. It's fun. Like you have not lived until you've made food with a 4-year-old.
Yeah, I haven't lived yet.
That is an experience. But she's getting really good at it because we go like watching, you know, real people make pizza and throwing the dough and stuff. So she's all excited about that. So she tried to throw the dough last night, and that was fun.
And did it end up like on the floor and everywhere else?
Oh, I mean, it was more like. Wow, Daddy, this is kind of heavy. Really get it off her hands. So, but anyway, as you say, that was a lot of fun making pizza with kids.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. What about you, Daniel? Did you make any brown butter this week?
No, that's the perils of being a grad student. Is that end of
it? Only takes five. It only takes 5 minutes.
Yeah, 5 minutes for the brown butter, but you're not going to see me here like drinking brown butter out of a mug.
Why not? Mm,
delicious.
Mm. I want to put brown butter in oatmeal now.
Yeah, oh, that would be a perfect candidate for some brown butter delivery.
I'm going to do that.
Which now also sounds like another term for taking a dump. Brown butter delivery. I didn't do any cooking this week, tragically.
Why?
I'll probably be baking something this Friday, though. It's a friend of my wife's and mine is having a pumpkin fest this weekend where everyone has to bring something with pumpkin, and she's bringing our friend is making some homebrew pumpkin ale for the for the party. So Valerie and I are bringing some these pumpkin oatmeal cookies. So. I would say this. I'll say this much. You wouldn't want to necessarily substitute brown butter for regular butter in a baking recipe. You would only want to add it as something that's a flavoring agent because what you do to butter affects its properties in food. So just be forewarned.
Is it like a different consistency or just too strong or what?
No, it's different. It's been altered chemically at that point. So like one of the critical things is you've boiled off most of the water.
Mm-hmm.
So that moisture content in butter is like an important factor. Like baking, I don't do a lot of baking because it scares the hell out of me. Like,
I agree.
Cooking you can improvise, but right. baking is a lot more of a science. Like it requires more precision, but it's like a moving target because if you have 2% more humidity in your kitchen the day you're cooking something or baking something, it can totally screw with your recipe.
Yeah.
And so I just really haven't gotten into it that much. I just know that, like, if you want to bake something, don't replace your butter with brown butter or it won't turn out right.
Hmm.
It might taste really rich, but it's not going to, you know, it's not going to do what you expect.
All right.
So use it on top of the waffles. Don't make the waffles with it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. That'd be incredible.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes.
We're going to try that this Sunday, I think. That sounds like
holy crap, yeah.
Poo-poo butter on waffles.
Poo-poo butter. And that will get the kids to eat it.
Your kids have the poo-poo butter. Doodle butter.
Oh, my goodness.
You can have anything you want in the whole universe.
We still have the menagerie to discuss.
I thought we were just going to start discussing it, and then somewhere in the middle of it, actually just cut to the first episode when we discussed the cage.
Yep, that would work too.
This podcast. Yep. Does that work too?
We could.
Okay.
So, All right, so we'll talk about this now. So Daniel, I guess, is Stephen, have you watched any of this at all?
Nope.
Or any of the other ones at all?
I watched the first couple, and
well, if you watch the first one, then
handle them.
Yeah. Well, if you watch the first one, you've seen this one basically.
Okay.
Oh, really? It's like they're basically just pulling in footage from the pilot.
Well, yes, that's exactly. That's yes. So this one was apparently when they were in the midst of filming the first season, they got into kind of a crunch where I guess this is what I've gleaned from reading the Wikipedia article about this episode. Because this special effects took longer to produce, and like this was just generally a more intensive process than a typical TV show of the day, they were kind of running behind. So they took the pilot episode and incorporated it into an ongoing episode, and so that they could get it's a two-parter. So they wrote one episode, you know, a wrapper around the pilot, and got two episodes out of it. So this is basically just the Cage in context of Kirk's crew.
Yeah, and it actually made for a pretty compelling story.
Yeah, they didn't change it much. They did change a little bit towards the end, but yeah.
That's kind of the most interesting thing I observed, even though I've only seen half of it. And admittedly, I haven't watched any of the other original Star Trek from this season. I just kind of started right here, like, which, since it's mostly the pilot, I guess it's okay.
Yeah.
But I felt like, and I hadn't watched any of the original series in a long time. But the thing that struck me was, I felt like the, it was weird. I felt like the editing of the show was very awkward. I felt like the acting was kind of stilted. Like, not just the stereotype of Kirk and his halting speech, but like, I felt like the acting in general was very halting. But the storytelling was very compelling. Like, I, you know, even after this podcast is done recording, I'm still going to watch the second half of that, because they crafted the story in such a way that I do want to see the rest of it. Which I thought was quite interesting, that like that to me is a real feat of storytelling, that it's been assembled in such a way that, at least for the first half of it, that it's drawn me in despite some other quibbles I have with the style of the show.
Yeah, and that's kind of the way Star Trek in general is for me. Like, there's certain aspects of it that just quite often are like, I don't know why I keep coming back to this, but there's something about it that is compelling. Yeah. And in this episode in particular, I'm not sure how I would feel if I had, you know, been around to watch this when it first came out and see it in context of what the other episodes came before it. But the pilot episode that this is based on never aired before this came out. It only aired in like 1988, like right before The Next Generation came out. So no one had seen this before, but us were like, we're going through and watching these for this podcast. Like, that was the first episode that's on Netflix, is The Cage. And it's not exactly the same, because they changed it up just a little bit to fit in the storyline that they built for this. But, yeah. So like, what did those of us who've watched it from the series from the beginning, what did you think of it? Kale and Jason.
Well, I have to say, this has been becoming my favorite part of the podcast, but this week I've been a very bad podcaster and I did not get to watch this episode.
Not at all?
And I feel really bad. Yeah.
Oh, you break my heart.
I know. It sounds extremely compelling, especially since, you know, I watched the episode that we're talking about, The Cage, but so.
Well, you've seen it.
Yes.
Jason, did you watch it?
Yeah, I got through almost. I actually didn't get to the very end of the second half, unfortunately. But I kind of know what happens, more or less.
Yeah.
I think that the 5-year-old that must have made the Commodore and Kirk's dress uniforms is probably got to be 40 now, and I just wonder what they went on to do for a living. Second of all, I feel so bad for the actor that plays Pike in this. That guy had the first cotton mouth. but no, seriously, it really was a compelling story, I think. It took what was a pretty good pilot, I think, anyway, and really wrapped it in an interesting story. I mean, here's something that I had seen. What did we watch, the Cage, like a month and a half ago or something?
Yeah.
And, you know, I said I'd seen it pretty recently, and I was excited to watch it all again and see how it's like, oh, that's what happened to Pike. I mean, you know, it kind of had that modern sense of, you know, so many movies now are prequels and sequels, and it kind of gave you this sense of, you know, where do these people come from? But like you say, that's us watching it now. The people who originally watched it had never seen this before. They were just seeing all these new characters and had no idea what was going on.
Right.
But anyway, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very good.
Huh.
So they explain in this one what happened to Pike?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
I mean, now one thing I need to point out that I don't think I realized till after I watched it was the actor playing Pike is not the same actor.
Oh, no.
Well, there's not... It's like a Stephen Hawking kind of character, though.
What?
He's wheelchair-bound and he can't talk.
Hmm. All right. Well, I've got to watch it now.
I think it's space wheelchair-bound.
Yeah, it's a space wheelchair. And he did, as Kirk said, had a space disaster. That caused a problem.
Okay.
Space disaster.
Before they invented the cure-all stick, the doctor can wave.
The what, Jason?
The cure-all stick, or whatever, the cure-all wand, the doctor can wave and just heal. Like, yep. Oh, you have cancer here, let me wave this little stick and it goes away.
Yep. Like Beverly Crusher has. Mm-hmm. What were you saying, Daniel?
Well, I said, there goes your laceration.
So, some interesting things about this, too, like, this was like 12 or 13 years before whatever. I mean, like the stuff that happened in the cage as they're in the context of the menagerie are 12 or 13 years before, I guess.
Fox says 11 for some reason.
Okay.
Yeah, on that order of magnitude. Yeah.
Like So Spock had apparently served with Pike for something like 10 years, like up to that point. So he had been serving with Pike longer than he had ever been with Kirk, like before or since. I mean, not to get all Star Trek nerdy, but Spock had a real allegiance to Pike. And like this whole rapper episode was kind of about how Spock was willing to essentially face the death penalty to help out Pike. And it's kind of weird in that way. Like, he did a whole lot of stuff that was like subversive, and that was cool. Like, I think I enjoyed the first episode of this better than the second, because that whole like Spock being a spy and like what the hell is he up to, and like giving people the Vulcan neck pinch, which I don't, has he ever done before in the series yet?
Yeah. I don't think so.
Yes, he has.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
it's, I think, is it, where the crazy googly eyes guy,
after
the bridge, and it seems like Spock gets behind him and gives him the, but I know he's done it at least once.
Ben Gilder.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah, it's, I agree, Trey, that first bit was really, really kind of cool, and you see Spock is definitely the centerpiece of that episode.
It seemed like there was more original content in the first half than the second.
Does Leonard Nimoy have some sort of weird accent, or is that a Canadian accent of some sort that I don't know?
I don't know.
Mm.
He just, I for some reason, I thought he was from New York or something. I never even bothered to look it up, but and he has a bit of a weird accent through some of this.
I hadn't noticed that.
Daniel, you mentioned about some of the kind of stilted acting, and I think I've said a number of times that they do kind of come across as wooden, particularly in that pilot episode. They're extremely wooden and stiff, I think.
Yeah. Well, just a lot of awkward pauses, too. Mm-hmm. And that part of that is that's also reflective of the problems in the editing that I was referring to as well. But it just, man, just a lot of... sometimes it feels like it's taking them a half second to register what somebody said before they react.
Yeah, a lot of staring off into space. Like,
space!
Is that space staring?
Yeah.
Leonard Nimoy is a Bostonian. He was born there.
Wicked.
Friend. To a Yiddish-speaking Orthodox Jewish immigrants from Izayaslav, Russia.
Maybe all that combines to make for an odd accent. I don't know. Or maybe it's just Leonard Nimoy doing some stuff.
His father was a baba.
So,
actually, down by the Haba?
Yeah, Baba by the Haba.
I've heard him talk a couple of times about some of the elements of this character, where he derived it from. And famously, something I don't think we've seen yet, or maybe at the end of this episode, I don't know, because I haven't got to it, the Vulcan hand sign, the live long and prosper, he actually took that. That's actually a kind of a hand shape that rabbis make during certain Jewish ceremonies.
What?
They're reading. They actually would do it with both hands. They would hold their hands up kind of, you know, at head or above head level while they're reading or saying a certain prayer. And to him, that kind of had, you know, kind of had the same connotation. Like, he felt like a Vulcan would be saying live long and prosper. That was like the closest a Vulcan would get to religion. And that they would have, you know, have this kind of ceremonial thing. And so he took that from his religion. I thought that was a very neat story. You'd never think that's where that would come from, right?
Wow.
I don't know if maybe the accent and some other bits and pieces of Vulcanism were all just Leonard Nimoy.
I'm going to have to research this Jewish hand sign.
Yeah, I'll have to look up the video. It's a great video of him talking about that. I'll post the link if I can find it in the show notes.
So another interesting aspect of this episode is apparently the term reality distortion field,
mm-hmm.
As it refers to Steve Jobs, was coined from people, you know, who had seen this episode, and the way that the Talosians, the big-headed aliens, can kind of just generate whatever they want people to see. Yeah, so that was apparently from this episode, which I guess the new Steve Jobs bio, Walter Isaacson's bio, mentions that. So I think that's fairly recent. I guess that had already shown up in the Wikipedia article when I read it last week or whatever. So that's interesting. So this is how people, you know, in the 60s saw this content, because The Cage hadn't been released yet. So I kind of wish that they organized this on Netflix, where it was like episode one is episode one and the pilot is like, you know, episode zero or episode whatever, 86. So it's like out of the flow.
Yeah, it's funny. Like the Chronicles of Narnia, that series of books by C.S. Lewis, they over time, you know, he wrote them the order he wrote them, but they weren't in any chronological order. So over the time, now publishers put them and number them by chronological order of the story, not the order in which he wrote them. But if you look at older sets, they're numbered differently. And
interesting.
I took a class at our church, and the associate pastor, who's about our, you know, 30-something guy, he had taken on his books and actually had taken a Sharpie and marked out the newer numbers and wrote in the older numbers from his childhood. Because he just thought that was wrong.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, I've had friends recommend that as well, too, because I've never read the whole series myself. I have it, but I bought it in a single volume where it's kind of in the chronological order, and all my friends said that if you read it in the chronological order, it kind of, the way it was written originally, if you read it chronologically, it spoils a lot of the stuff in some of the other volumes that happened chronologically later.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's like, if, you know, all of the six of the Star Wars films were to be on Netflix.
Oh, my God.
With the only three.
Oh, my God.
Sorry, knee-jerk reaction there.
Chronological's not always better.
Yeah, agreed. Wow, good point.
Yeah, it'll happen at some point.
Sure. Trey, that's a good idea, though. It'd be neat on shows like this if they could say, you know, Netflix, it could somehow, you know, take the cage and take it out of the order and just say, this isn't just episode one. This is, you know, a pilot. This is kind of a different out of the order.
Right. Exactly.
Now, that's an unfortunate thing that happens with a lot of, like, serial television, actually. Certainly still happens these days where they do have an intended order, and like, sitcoms get screwed up that way all the time, where you'll have, you know, the network decides that they want to air a particular episode at a particular time just so that they can shoehorn, like, a Halloween episode in somewhere, for example.
Yeah, and there's a lot of Seinfeld episodes like that. I mean, not that that storyline matters, but they aired them in different order than they were taped and written and that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're even in the, like, correct order, I think that's not exactly the way it aired with the first season of Star Trek.
Yeah, most of that effect on Wikipedia, aren't there?
Yeah. So, okay, those of us who watched any at all, let's give a star rating. I'll go first. And this is from my own experience of watching it as I've gone through. Blame Netflix. But I'm going to give this a 2 stars. It felt mediocre because I had seen this story already. I understand there's more to it in historical context and that this was, you know, the way people had experienced that. But like myself, I saw that this was a wrapper around the pilot that I've already seen and that it felt like one of these rerun episodes where it's like all flashbacks.
A clip show.
It's a clip show for me. I understand there's probably more to it, but for me, 2 stars.
Out of what? Out of 5?
Yeah. So, Jason, you watched most of it.
Yeah, I would. I was going to say 4.
All right, that's okay. Yeah. We don't have to agree.
We have to come to a consensus.
Ah, no.
I really would say 4. I mean, I think, like I said before, I think it made for a really compelling story. Surprisingly, given when I found it was a rapper, I was like, wait a second, I've seen all this. What are they showing on the screen here? And I thought it was going to be like, you know, a minute or two clip, and they kept going with it. But I was excited to watch the second one. I'm going to finish it up here in just a little bit.
Nice.
I would say I think it was a 4. I think it was a good story. It was, and just in terms like kind of more meta than the story, what an awesome use of a pilot episode they had lying around.
Yeah.
To really bring it into the fold and make it canon.
I think, I mean, we weren't rating stuff when we first started doing this, and I would probably give The Cage a 4. But, yeah, I'm being narrow-sighted here. Short-sighted. And if we were going to rate the individuals' episodes, if we wanted to... But I think this... I don't think that's really necessary, but this is one story. But I would give the first half of it a little bit of a higher rating, but... I'm going to stick with that.
Maybe that's the problem, Trey, is I didn't get all through the second half. So maybe now it's like the last 10.
Well, there was also some weird stuff where the cliffhanger at the end of the first episode was Spock being like incarcerated. Spock was telling Kirk, please let me finish the transmission. It'll all make sense to you. And Kirk says, no, lock him up. And then when it starts, the second part, that's not mentioned.
That was unclear to me because initially, like when Bones like he asked him, he's like, you know, is confinement enough?
Yeah.
Like, have him confined to his room. But when Kirk was like, lock him up, I got the impression it was like, put him in a jail cell.
Right. Yeah. And that was just not mentioned in the second part at all.
I don't know, I guess I almost took it as like, not tonight. We're going to go on to bed, but maybe that's the dad in me.
Oh. And another
fuck bedtime.
Another weird thing about it was in terms of the remastering stuff, which Daniel, we've talked about a bunch, like they in 2006, they did like this CGI redo. It seemed like with this,
I thought that seemed like that was the case.
Yeah. In parts of this, like the cage had been redone, but in parts of this, it seemed like there were little snippets where it was the old version and then little snippets where it was the new version. So that was kind of weird too. Yeah. So anyway, Jason, did you finish watching the Corbomite maneuver?
Oh, yes. Kale, was it you when we were discussing that said that you kind of thought that was kind of the best of Star Trek with it?
Yeah, he gave it a five and a half, since Kirk was naked.
Right. Yeah, I just thought the story was really compelling, just more high level than some of the other episodes.
I'm going to give it a five. And I won't dwell on it too long because I know that was 2 weeks ago and we're talking about a different episode now. But the one point I wanted to make is, to me, that was solidly the first episode of Star Trek where we saw that, you know, this show was going to be about a little more high-mindedness. It was going to be about, you know, we're not going to blast people out of the water to win the situation. And sometimes the subversive thing to do is to, you know, think and you know, be more human and to, you know, appeal to a higher sensibility. So I thought that was kind of like this. Okay, this is what Star Trek is going to be about. Is this means, you know, that it's not just about going down to a planet and blasting something with a zapper and sleeping with a green woman. Which, yeah. We haven't seen a lot of that yet, but I mean, that's to me that was kind of just, you know, pure Star Trek.
Yeah, that was a great episode.
Mm-hmm. And Clint Howard is, after having seen the whole thing, order of magnitude creepier. Voice that they dubbed over or whatever. Oh my god.
Yeah. Now, you know, the voice of the rubber-faced alien was Lurch, right?
I did not.
Oh. Yeah. I put that in the show notes for the last episode.
Oh, I didn't. I listened to it, but I didn't read through all of the show notes. Great interstitials, by the way. I'm looking forward to hearing.
Oh, thanks.
I'm not getting too mad at talking about the podcast on the podcast. But
that's all right.
Well done.
Thanks. Ted Cassidy, a.k.a. Lurch, a.k.a. Ruck from, what's the name of that episode with the android sex slave?
Mm-hmm. Something girl or something boy. Or
What Are Little Girls Made Of?
Yep.
Yeah, so he's a recurring voice and character, I guess. Cool.
So Kale, you didn't watch any of this one yet, so
no, and yeah, I'm surprised at Trey's rating because it sounds like it's very, I don't know, a very important episode.
Yeah, that was a selfish rating, but I'm gonna stick with it for now. that's how I felt about it when I was watching it. Like that's my entertainment quotient or whatever.
Daniel. Given that you've seen the first episode and maybe getting into the second one, do you care to rate at least just the first? Or
yeah, that's good.
I'm really tempted to, but
yeah, do it.
It's only half. Of,
do it.
No, I
do it.
Nope.
Come on.
I've got to withhold.
You have to. I
don't think it's fair because I feel like the two episodes together, despite the fact they were split over the sake of, you know, they're airing into two episodes, they're part of a single like narrative. So I
all right.
So I'm just count me snobby that way. I just
well, could we can get you to rate this one with the understanding that you could amend it in the next episode of Jaw Grind.
Okay, then that being the case, I would agree with your rating, Trey. I think 2 out of 5 is fair. Like,
and we got the pessimistic crowd in the hizzle.
Well, I'm just really like a snobby dork when it comes to, you know, the acting and TV production and movie production and all that. I'm a real wannabe about being in the know when it comes to filmmaking and the craft of visual storytelling and all that crap, you know.
I wonder in terms of the acting and the portrayals, though, how this stacks up against other shows that were in prime time during this era.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I wonder how much of it is just a reflection of this is the way acting is done in the 60s versus now. I mean,
well, I'd stipulate acting on television in the 60s, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I should. Well, prime time.
Because even if we're talking about, like, you know, space science fiction, like, you know, it was only 2 years after this that we had 2001, right? Or 1 year after.
Nice.
This came out in 66, and then 2001 came out in, like, 67 or 68?
Yeah, maybe even 69.
Huh. But, like, you know, so, I mean, that to me is like a definitive kind of
68
story. 68?
Yeah. Right.
Should have stuck with my first number. But, you know, so I... Yeah, it would. Now I'm just really curious about TV in the 60s.
Yeah, that's interesting. You bring up 2001 though, because that movie is just light years ahead of Star Trek in like every way.
Yeah. Well,
no pun intended.
Well, the thing about I put those into almost different categories of storytelling, because Star Trek you have to suspend disbelief in that aliens look like people. Like, it's absurd, and I accept that to enjoy Star Trek. Whereas 2001 is like, it's Arthur C. Clarke. You know, I see that as more Arthur C. Clarke than Kubrick. I mean, Kubrick was a great filmmaker, whatever, but Arthur C. Clarke, like, near and dear to my heart. And the like, kind of hard science fiction that he did, where...
Seriously, there's a 1960s American television series page on Wikipedia. Specifically 1960s American television series.
There you go.
Like,
read up.
List. There's too much to read, but the Batman show was on at the same time too.
Right.
So for all its flaws, I don't think it was, I wouldn't characterize the acting as stilted or wooden.
And that's a good comparison too. Like, I enjoy Frank Miller Batman, you know, Dark Knight Returns, and I enjoy Adam West TV series. Like, they're totally, utterly different. But yeah,
Dragnet was on in the 60s.
This is true.
That was fantastic. From my memory, at least.
From Nick at Night.
Oh yeah. it started in the 50s. It ended around 1970. So it was kind of long in the tooth by the time Star Trek was on.
But I do think, just kind of go back to Daniel, that you mentioned 2001. I think Trey's right. I mean, it's pretty much the only thing that these two have in common is, you know, airy science fiction. And it pretty much ends right there. I mean, you know, you have, on one hand, you know, a very high-minded, you know, writer in Arthur C. Clarke who, you know, was talking about, you know... it's almost philosophical, but in a very different, you know, much more existence, you know, existential kind of way.
Yeah, it was like existentially philosophical, whereas Roddenberry, I guess, was more socially philosophical.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And
hence the hit you in the face with the social commentary kind of characterization that you often hear about the about Star Trek as a whole.
Well, and Star Trek was hundreds of years past 2001. Like, it is, it's like set.
I'm going there now.
What's that?
No, I'm amused by the merging of the show's conceptual plates in human timeline.
Yeah, well, they even, like, the star dates were supposed to obscure how far in the future it was. It's like, this is so far in the future that these technological things are just not an issue. Whereas 2001, it's like, a trip to the moon is supposed to be significant.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah. 2001, then we're supposed to go to Jupiter. We totally ruined it.
Yeah. No, we went. We sent unmanned probes anyway before then.
Yes, and they probably discovered the new life form growing on the moon of Jupiter. But yeah. We missed out.
Yeah. Well, it, actually, in the book, it was Saturn.
Oh. Yeah, I'm giving it away that I...
But even in 2001, the technology just feels so much higher than what you see in Star Trek. I don't know. Maybe it's just the budget difference, but...
Yeah, I just think that it's... I mean, like, that's not an invalid point for sure, because I find the effects in 2001, and this is probably because they made choices to be kind of, like, severe and like, simple and stripped down with a lot of it, but when I saw 2001 for the first time, I was like, this came out, like, 9 years before A New Hope, and it to me, the quality of the effects, the believability of them was beyond that.
Yeah.
From a movie from, like, almost a decade prior.
Yeah, well, and it's not adventure science fiction, it's hard science fiction. Like, yeah. When there's...
Until the third act, perhaps.
Well, but the thing is, like, when there's a spaceship, when people are out, like, outside, all you hear is breathing. You don't hear the whoosh of a spaceship, because you can't hear anything in space.
Yeah. Warbly spaceship noises.
Yeah.
So, now you sound like Roman on Party Down.
What?
Have you ever seen or heard of Party Down?
No.
That's on Netflix. It's the only way I've ever seen it, because it was I don't have, like, premium channels, and it was short-lived... comedy on Showtime. I think it lasted 2 seasons and had like Adam Scott, who's in Parks and Rec, was the lead role. Lizzie Kaplan was probably one of the lead actresses. Ken Marino, who I think was one of the original members of The State, he's in it. And there's this one character who's like a sci-fi writer, and he's always going on about hard science fiction.
Well, and that's the thing is I appreciate when someone can follow hard science fiction, but I appreciate Star Trek. I love Star Trek, and it is totally unrealistic in countless ways, but that's okay. It's an adventure show, you know, it's like,
oh yeah.
But you know, there's certain elements of it that are perhaps plausible, but
like, oh, so, I'm not knocking. I'm just noticing the. I know you're just drawing the distinction.
Yeah.
The communicator is that possible?
The communicator. What? It's totally realistic.
So basically, from Star Trek, we got the flip phone, and then from Arthur C. Clarke, we got the telecommunication satellite.
That's right. In real life, yeah.
You actually work hand in hand, as it turns out. So maybe
about that?
More to this link than we realized.
How about that? Good call.
Cool. Yeah, and then definitely, you know, we're in a time right now where television is more of the cutting edge medium in terms of storytelling and sometimes even special effects, but not always.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, that's a recent thing. I mean, certainly during the 60s, the small screen was, you know, little stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, little serial dramas maybe, but the big screen was still where the epics happened. And you know, that's where you get a budget. And that's why you had, you know, a director like Stanley Kubrick, who was, you know, kind of a young, you know, visionary and a perfectionist, and, you know, would spend whatever budget it took to make the scene look just perfect, like what Daniel's describing, you know. That's why you would have that only on the big screen, where now, I mean, you know, we might see something like that on, you know, on television and not think anything about it now.
Yeah. That's a good point.
So apples and oranges, that's all.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I enjoy them both in their own way.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And there's not a lot of hard science fiction either. Like, most stuff is fairly dumbed down.
flaccid science fiction, if you will. Because I'm the kind of guy who goes there.
Yeah. What other, like, hard science fiction is there that you can think of? Something like maybe, what's that one? Is it Moon? Is that the one with...
Sam Rockwell. Moon was one that came to mind.
Very, very much kind of a 2001 flavor.
I have yet to see that, and I really want to see that.
It's pretty good.
But a lot of times, hard science fiction really comes out as, you know... I mean, couldn't Moon almost have been just like a survivor tale? It couldn't have been like a remote area of Africa he was in for all purposes. I mean,
yeah,
the science fiction setting is really almost just a byproduct. It's not the story in itself. When you get into science, almost science fantasy, that's whenever, you know, the technology they're describing is more of the what if this existed, how would it change the world kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you see a lot less of that, I think, in hard science fiction because, again, it has to be more plausible and has a lot more real-world rules as we understand them. But then again, neutrinos are going faster than light these days, so what do I know?
Where does something like Blade Runner fit in that whole continuum? Because I think it's fair to say it's probably a continuum. I mean,
I would...
if you have, you know...
There's nothing unrealistic about that in and of itself if you concede that there's androids that are indistinguishable from humans, then yeah, that's totally hard science fiction, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's kind of framed in that whole, like, you know, neo-noir or the I can't stand the term, but it's apt, the cyberpunk, like the early cyberpunk kind of conceptualization, but it seems to me like a lot of it's trying to portray, like, this is your future.
Right. And so the dystopian thing is, I guess, usually harder than the idealistic stuff like Star Trek.
And I can't remember if that's the first time where the phrase the used universe was coined in reference to a movie. Like, that was certainly, like, science fiction movies that came out before that kind of used that concept, even, you know, whether A New Hope is one of the earliest ones or not, I don't know, but... like, you know, that's one of the visually distinguishing things between, like, Star Wars or Blade Runner or a lot of other contemporary sci-fi movies, that when compared to kind of early, you know, earlier 20th century up through, you know, whether it's Star Trek or THX-1138 or other stuff where it's like, this looks lived in instead of sterile.
Right.
Actually, you know, maybe even Soylent Green has that kind of feeling to it. If any of you have seen Soylent Green.
Yeah.
Which I actually think is a really fantastic movie.
Really?
I think that I liked it. I mean, the end is like cheesy. That's what everybody always remembers. But I thought it was a really fascinating movie, like, when I saw it a few years ago. And I think that's from, like, 73.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't that impressed with that one. I mean, as far as Charlton Heston movies go, I mean, Planet of the Apes was... you know, that was a good sci-fi movie.
What's the Omega Man? Is the other Charlton Heston?
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
It's the I Am Legend. You know, the
Last Man on Earth. The End. Omega. The End.
Yeah, there was a whole long series. It was the late '60s, early '70s of kind of those. I don't know, like social dystopian type science fiction film that was kind of a popular.
Yeah.
Interesting note, in Soylent Green, they make reference to the greenhouse effect in the early 70s.
Was Burgess Meredith in that movie?
Yeah, I think he was. He was like the...
he was the death man or whatever. Like the, in his suicide rooms?
Oh, no, now I don't remember. Because, yeah, the guy that was his, like, roommate was a different old guy. So I don't remember.
I'm not confusing that with oh, shit.
Logan's Run.
Logan's Run. I don't think I'm confusing it with Logan's Run.
There's a whole list of those movies.
Yeah.
So I was just actually paging through the hard science fiction topic on Wikipedia, which, of course, is the definitive thing of all human knowledge. And apparently we're not the only ones who have a hard time thinking of films, because under representative works, it's only... literature. There's no manga.
Yeah.
there's no films listed.
There's a lot of hard science fiction, novels. Well, it seems like all of Clark's stuff is in that genre. In comparison, I mean, anyway.
I have the impression that if he could have, he'd have gone on and just been a scientist. It's almost like writing about it was kind of what he was left with.
Yeah. Yeah, enjoyed the hell out of his stuff. Anyway.
Well, good stuff. I mean, I definitely could go down the rabbit hole of talking about science fiction. All right, well, we'll maybe add some more films, that sort of stuff. I'm sure we've all got some favorite science fiction films from over the years for various reasons. That's always sometimes the fun thing to talk about is, like, why did you like that? Because especially whenever it's, like, Dan, you mentioned, like, Soylent Green. And sometimes it's almost like the butt of a joke nowadays. But
right.
I mean, it is a good movie. I mean, it does. And it, I think whenever people first saw it, they were just shocked. But
yeah.
Yeah, I need to watch that again.
It's become like a cultural icon for the wrong reason because of that overwrought final line.
Right.
But you could say the same thing about the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Well, I think the Planet of the Apes actually was fairly cheesy, though, if you look at it, like, would be on the soft side of sci-fi.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've never actually read the original story.
No, I haven't either.
Well, I guess the original story is actually in French, but right. I've never read the original story translated. But it's much more bitter and dark, from what I recall.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, these are the things that we will write up for another time.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. So Dan, are you gonna call back in next time?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought this was pretty awesome. I'll try not to run my mouth so much.
No, that's what this is here for.
Yeah, from the point
running of mouths.
The grinding of jaws.
The grinding of jaws, exactly.
There it is.
Cool. All right, so let's we'll plan on this time next week if that works.
Next
for
week is Thanksgiving.
We'll plan on this week after next. Yeah, that's a good point. All right, so it's going to be another 2 week thing. Yeah, I'll be out of town all next week, so.
Would I Thanksgiving special?
We could do a best of clip show.
That's nice.
Just kind of take the first episode and wrap it in the middle of a couple.
Yeah. Now you're talking.
Now I'm being obviously meta.
Of what happened to Jason Johnson.
Oh, man. No Jason, no Phil. Phil just messaged in on a group me. He apparently forgot what day it was.
Definitely than I care to admit myself, actually.
Okay. Cool. Well, good show, guys.
All right. Yep. Nice to meet you, gents.
You too.
Cool.
Good talking to you guys.
All right. Good night.
Till next time.
See ya.
Bye.